Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are, whenever you are. Welcome to The Asian Highway. This is our fifth episode of The Asian Highway, Storytellers in Action. On today's highway, we have Ani Sonnenfeld, founder of a human rights organization. She's also a she's also quite involved in the music scene. She's been in LA for quite a bit, but she's been around the world as well. But before we get to her, of course, I want to bring along my two co-hosts here in Little Tokyo at Visual Communications. I'm Pimo, of course, and we've got Debesh and Mehta also here in studio. And Debesh, I actually want to set you up with a quick chat. I know we're recording this episode on the heels of International Women's Day. And there was quite a, I guess you want to call a significant occurrence in Pakistan the other day? Or
yeah.
You want to delve into that real quick?
Yeah, for sure. So I found this article, I believe it was yesterday, a couple of days ago. So there is a new elected Pakistani senator by the name of Krishna Kumari from the Sindh province. And so she is a minority senator elected in the Sindh province in Pakistan very recently from the Pakistan's People's Party. And the reason that this is significant, first of all, is I think she's the first female.
Right,
she is a Dalit, mm-hmm. which is what is commonly known as the untouchable caste. Beyond that, though, she's also, I believe, the first Hindu female senator elected in Pakistan. So there's a lot of firsts there. So there's a lot of ceiling breaking, which I thought was really cool. And interestingly, when asked about, you know, how did you get to this point, she said that, well, you know, I was fortunate to have a lot of support from my family, my parents, in getting my education, getting a university degree, and eventually working her way up through. And then really the people really spoke and liked what she brought to the table. And, you know, here in lo and behold, she beat out a lot of other candidates that were seemingly more likely to win. So I thought that was really cool, especially on the heels of International Women's Day and what this could possibly mean for Pakistan. I know Pakistan a lot of times gets a lot of negative light about a lot of political issues, but I thought this was definitely something worth mentioning.
So, Mehta, let's rope you in. I know you know the politics of the region pretty well. Kind of what are your thoughts on the evolving nature of Pakistani politics and how it relates to the rest of the world?
Well, you know what? There was an article recently. Benazir Bhutto's son had written an article about how she was both a mother and a politician and managed to balance both, and that it's possible to be an attentive mother while, you know, being in the limelight and pursuing what she did. And the basis of the article, I think, was that she didn't complain about being a woman. But I think it's interesting that in South Asia, Sri Lanka, India, Pakistan, we've always had female
as well as Bangladesh. As well as
and Bangladesh, mm-hmm. yes. We've had female politicians from early on, Bandar Narke, Indira Gandhi. I'm glad this
whom
is
I met.
Oh.
Yes.
Well, that's a perfect introduction, Ani. Let's introduce our guest today. Ani, tell us about this meeting that you had.
Well, my father was a diplomat, and we lived in India for about 4.5 years as a teenager. And whenever we had receptions and government events, we would always have dignitaries. And I met Indira Gandhi. I met Morarji Desai, who was the president at that time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So just chilling.
You know, Morarji Desai used to apparently drink his own pee, and that's what kept him alive
for a long time.
Many years.
Yes. Interesting.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Fountain of youth.
Exactly. Yeah.
Fountain of something.
Fountain of something, yes. Anyways, let's get into more about you, Ani. I know we have a lot to talk about today. We'll try to get as much in as we can. And I'm going to yield the floor to Mehta, and she's going to start off our questions here.
Well, Ani, we're excited to have you here because you're a Grammy Award-winning musician and an activist. And you're from Malaysia, but moved to LA, and you've grown up in all these countries. So you were born in Malaysia, but grew up in Germany, Egypt, and India before coming to LA. So what do you identify as?
A citizen of the world. I actually identify with values. I think at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what religion, race, mm-hmm. Tribe you are. I think it's all about values, and I think that's probably, it was an easy transition for me from being a full-time songwriter, producer, to becoming a human rights activist, right? Even no matter what occupation you do, there's always good people, and I think that, I think it's people's values and their character that really that draws me to individuals and individuals draw to me. And I think working in human rights is there's a sea of good people, and who wouldn't want to be in that environment, right?
Right, exactly.
But growing up, in, I mean, I'm also a fellow diplomat, and I also grew up in several countries like you. My background has a little bit to do with what I'm pursuing right now as an adult. How did it influence what you're doing as an adult and how you pursued music?
Yeah. Well, I've always been very passionate about music. I took piano lessons. I'm classically trained since I was 5 years old. And so that's been the backbone of my music education. But while living in all those different places, I always took up different music instruments. And I basically played the tabla, I played the sitar, I played whatever I could get my hands on. And my parents were very supportive of that. So in addition to the classical training, I also took up all these ethno instrumentations.
Sure.
So that really broadened my musical my understanding of an instrument. And so when I started doing writing and production, you know, I had to kind of figure my way into it because I didn't know you could do songwriting and earn a living at that time.
Wow.
So I went to the United States when I was 18. I came here when I was 18 to study economics and political science because I was supposed to go back to Malaysia and join the Foreign Service, right? Because that's what my dad wanted me to do. But, you know how our Asian parents are.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
no.
Exactly.
You
we all know too well. Yes.
Do this now.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, after I graduated, I said to him, well, you know, I've kept my promise, and so I want to do what I want to do, and that's music, and I really wanted to give it a shot. So I moved from Illinois to Los Angeles, and I just honed in on songwriting. And so I just did some mundane job and saved all the money and bought equipment. So for a long time, I was doing programming and production. And so for a girl, that's not exactly your niche.
Mm-hmm.
And so speaking of Women's Days, I mean, there's during that time, and still is, there's a lot of sexism in the music industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not just racism, but also sexism.
Right.
And if you're a woman, your expected role is to be a singer and a lyricist. And so playing keyboards, doing all these instruments, programming and production, that's a guy's territory.
Mm-hmm.
And so so that was also a very challenging time. And, you know, music industry is very different than being in the diplomatic field, too, because mm-hmm. there's no etiquette.
Right,
it's
right.
A dog-eat-dog world. Mm-hmm. People make up their own rules. And, it's I was a real fish out of water from being in a diplomatic environment
mm-hmm.
where there's etiquette, there is political norms. I mean, there's, you know, there's
decorum.
Yeah.
Like that, yeah.
And then you go into this really crazy world of music entertainment business.
Yeah. God, that's so true.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to throw in a question about somebody you collaborated with. I've actually had the opportunity to interview Kebmo way back in the day, maybe about 10, 15 years
ago.
I got to have a good conversation with him.
He's a sweet guy.
He's an amazing guy. I mean, he's brilliant. He's well-spoken.
Yeah.
And so I'm just curious how that collaboration came about, and not just the collaboration, but, you know, after working with him and, you know, how his activism kind of maybe melded in with whatever you're doing.
I have such a nice story to share with you.
All right, please do.
Right. So as a songwriter producer, one of the things that you do is you program the song and you hire musicians to play mm-hmm. tracks,
sure.
you know, play on your mm-hmm. tracks. And you hire a singer that matches the genre that your song is targeting.
Sure.
So I used to hire Kevin to play guitar on my sessions.
Oh, wow.
And he was so broke at that time.
Uh-huh.
I would have to go pick him up, do the session, pay him. And I didn't pay him a lot because I didn't have a lot of money, right? We all didn't have a lot of money.
Yeah, struggling artist, right?
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
And then dropping him off. And he's just a great guy. So I was more than happy to do that. But, you know, he's the kind of guy that remembered that.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he got big as a blues artist, because mm-hmm. he transitioned from being a guitar player to becoming an artist,
right.
That's when he really blew up.
Mm-hmm.
And he never forgot that. And he always called me up. He said, hey, come and collaborate with me. Mm-hmm. And so we wrote together mm-hmm. and on a couple of projects. And one got a Grammy nomination. And, mm-hmm. and the second one won a Grammy.
Sure.
So.
Very cool. Being that you both kind of work together,
yeah.
And he's also quite the activist. Was there any kind of, I guess, collaboration you were able to figure on that end or
no,
supporting? Or
no, it was at that time I wasn't. And it was purely just being around good souls.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, right. and in the music business, it's very rare.
It is, yeah.
So jumping on that activism point, though, obviously you founded Muslims with Progressive Values, mm-hmm. also known as MPV, as I'm coming to know. Besides, you know, like coming up with that name and everything, I know 9/11 also played quite a big factor with that. So can you walk us through how that whole process evolved to the point where you decided to create this organization?
Right. So after 9/11, my personal journey, I think we all go through a transformative journey mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. you to make mm-hmm. such a transition
yeah.
and for you to be crazy dedicated to it.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way you, me, anyone could be committed for a cause without pay, without any really rewards day to day if you didn't have that fire in the belly
yeah.
and if you personally were not transformed by a particular experience.
Sure.
So my experience was that after 9/11, I decided to restudy the Quran for myself. I decided, you know what? I really need to come out of the closet as a Muslim, because in the music business, I was a closeted Muslim.
Mm. That's an interesting
decision,
idea
or
status.
Yeah. And very few people knew. Kevin knew, a few other folks that I worked with, Melissa Manchester knew, mm-hmm. and a few other people that I worked with that I felt safe with
sure.
knew.
No.
Because I also knew those that found out that I was were not very friendly to me after that. So I kept that very close. I was a Muslim, you know, born and raised. That is my identity. And so when 9/11 happened, I decided, you know, I really needed to come out of the closet. But in order for you to do that, I needed to know my Islam. Mm. I needed to know what it really stood for. And I knew I was going to get the hard questions because, you know, you just had the terrorists. But I also went to school in Illinois and I had an experience there where nobody knew what Islam was. Nobody knew what a Muslim is. And it was just that ignorant. So if you imagine the middle of America, or most of America for that matter, had no clue what Islam or Muslim is, and then the next thing they knew was terrorism, there's a huge gap in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had experience speaking to that middle.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to relearn. And in the process of relearning, I really decided to be very pure in my intention. And that is, if I'm going to leave Islam as a result of this, so be it. And if I come closer to Islam as a result of it, then so be it. And what I did was, my journey was, it was self-taught. I had a lot of books. And the beauty about being in the United States is that you have access to all sorts of books. Whereas if you're in the Muslim country, it's all censored, mm-hmm. right? So with that accessibility to information, that is one way of really empowering yourself, educating yourself, mm-hmm. and that's what I did. And what I found, that the Quran was really rife with social justice. It was really rooted in social justice
mm-hmm.
for the 7th century. So the fact that women, it's, you know, had the right to work, to decide who to marry, when to marry, and to earn a living, to keep that money for herself, that's profound.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we didn't have those rights until the 60s in the United States. And,
true,
you know,
mm-hmm.
so this happened 1400 years ago. So then I started reading the Quran from the context of history and the social context.
Mm-hmm.
Then it
mm-hmm.
makes all the sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start asking yourself, well, why the hell are we practicing the Islam that we do today? Because it's wrong on so many levels. And so the values are not there. The egalitarian values are not there. The social justice issue is not there.
Right.
You know, which is, if that is what the Quran is and all these Muslims claim to be is following the Quran, why are they not following the Quran?
Right.
So at that point, I said, there's no way I can go back to the mosque that I was a part of. because then I would be perpetuating the misogyny, the homophobic teaching, just, you know, the whole nine yards.
You know, having said that, and I, you know, I can totally appreciate that in my undergrad, I minored in comparative religions, and the Abrahamic religions, particularly Islam, was always very fascinating to me. You know, in our current political climate, in our current just climate in general, there's quite a few people out there that are not so inviting towards Islam. Some believe they're so extreme that to say that, you know, Islam is something that should be eradicated from mm-hmm. the earth, from society. How do you approach, how do you bring those people to the table? How do you approach them? What do you, besides education, which I know we talked about briefly, you know, how do you tackle something like that?
It's actually quite easy because you don't speak to them in terms of, oh, so you want to eradicate Islam, eh? And then start a fight. That does not work. And so you ask them, what is it about Islam that bothers you? And I sort of got a lot of times is the same thing that I actually agree with, right? So for example, oh, I hate the fact that, look, all this anti-Islam, anti-Muslim is very extreme right now.
Right.
But it didn't happen out of a vacuum, right? Mm-hmm. It started from 9/11 and it's gotten worse after 9/11. And particularly with the rhetoric and the fear-mongering that's going on. It's an easy target.
Right.
But if you talk to these people, they don't like the same things. They judge Muslims and they're very anti-Islam, anti-Muslim based on the fact that, oh, you guys are so misogynistic, you guys are so homophobic, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
So you dispel the labels and you go to the roots. Mm-hmm. And the roots is, what are your values? But the thing is, what's really funny is that the same people that hate Muslims, they're just as misogynistic and as homophobic.
Yes, very much so. Yeah, very much so. A lot of those values that they're against, I think they end up following whether they're aware of that or not.
So those are the hypocrites. But there are some genuine Americans out there who are not prejudiced because they want to be prejudiced. They're struggling to find an Islam that is egalitarian, that agrees with their values.
Mm-hmm.
Who, you know, so those Americans do exist. I've seen them. I'll share one experience. I was speaking at a Christian conference, concert, festival
mm-hmm.
in North Carolina some years ago, and I usually hang out after I speak and sing, and to interact with the audience. And this was a Christian audience, so this elderly man came up to me and says, I want to talk to you. And he said to me, look, I hate everything about Islam and all Muslims. But when I saw your name and you were going to talk about progressive Islam, what is progressive Islam? Something compelled me to come and listen to you. And I'm really glad I did. And then he started crying.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you know, hearing you speak and hear you sing has lifted that hate from me.
Mm-hmm.
Hate is not pretty. Hate kills you. It doesn't kill me. It kills you, the
mm-hmm.
hater.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really touched by that. That for me is one of the most beautiful experiences.
Wow.
Yeah.
Right. That is amazing.
Yeah.
Yoda wasn't wrong, the dark side and what it leads to.
Right.
So. But you know, at the same time, are there people who sort of respond to negative narratives because they feel that people on the left are sort of shoving ideas down their throat or
I think the problem with Muslims is right now in the West in particular, and I understand it to a degree, but if you deflect responsibility, you just make it worse, you know, because people, the only way to get over this, this discrimination towards Muslims, towards minorities, is for us to speak up and for us to address. Yes, we have radicalism in our midst, Muslims. And so when these supposed religious leaders in America say, oh, Islam is a religion of peace, I'm like, are you kidding me? Islam may, but Muslims aren't, because you look at the Muslim world is a disaster, it's imploding, and it's because of the theology of violence, the theology of hate. So how can you say Islam is a religion of peace? Because if it is, it would be a peaceful world, particularly in the Muslim world.
I was also a foreign student in the Midwest in Ohio while you were in Illinois. And when we were international students, we always had to be very aware of the fact that one student's behavior could affect all of us reputation-wise.
Yeah. Right.
Yes.
And that's, you know, when it came to jobs and stuff like that. So how do you deal with the deviance, I guess, is the best way to describe it.
You just be critical of them. That you just have to be critical of them. Mm. Because if you don't, then you're just endorsing them. Silence is endorsement.
Mm-hmm. But does that get exhausting at some point? If there's quite a few people that are deviants or people that sort of, you know, go away from the central.
Of course. No, it is. It does get exhausting, but that's why as an organization, our job is not to keep issuing statements after statements, because after all, that's all we'll be doing.
Sure. Right.
And so the work that we do is actually eradicating the justification, the Islamic justification for human rights and mm-hmm. all these abuses. So when people who take the time to delve into the work that we do, they say, okay, this is an organization that addresses the issue at its root. Mm-hmm. And we don't beat around the bush about that.
Right. So. I do want to ask a follow-up in the sense that, you know, there's one thing we hear from one side of the political spectrum is that by focusing on groups, you know, whatever the group is, you know, religion or, you know, sexuality, whatever.
Yeah.
That it's actually more divisive than it is unifying. And in fact, Bill Murray recently said in an interview that the reason Democrats won't make any progress is because they're focusing on too much on groups. And so I guess the question is, how do you address that? I mean, because I find that counterintuitive to even think that way. So just what are your thoughts on that kind of thought process?
No, it is. This is – so our advocacy is about inclusion. Mm-hmm. It is when we're talking about women's rights, you know, men and boys need to be at the table because, you know, that's an issue.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, that's the root of the issue. So one of our projects that we work on, we have an initiative called Imams for She, and we work with imams, male imams, who are actually – are feminists. They champion women and girls' rights. And it's powerful. And so they do exist, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when we, and here in the West, it's interesting because I'd be speaking at the Commission on the Status of Women, which is a United Nations annual convening of nonprofits and UN and states and all that. And that's coming up in New York in a week's time. And we're going to be there. But I'll be speaking at a panel that is hosted by a feminist organization, and then the woman will come up to me and says, you know, why do you have to talk about Islam? I'm like, excuse me, you're a feminist. You're talking about empowering your own identity. You're trying to put mine down.
Right,
you know, I'm not just a woman.
Right.
You know, I'm X, Y, and Z. I mean, everybody has multifaceted identities.
Sure,
and
it's
so ridiculous. And so I've come to the point where we've been doing this for more than 10 years, and it's always been about inclusion. And that is whether you're a man, woman, straight, LGBT, atheist, what have you, it doesn't matter what tribe you are. And that's why I was saying earlier on, for me, it's about values.
Mm-hmm.
But the beautiful thing, what's going on right now is Trump is actually unifying everyone. It took Trump to do it. Because now when I'm working with LGBT organizations and we're talking about legislation, about adding LGBT on civil rights legislations or various, you know, employment rights and so on, they're trying to include LGBT, but not just LGBT, but also sex, meaning it's not just about LGBT anymore. It's also inclusive of women. So LGBT organizations are actually including women in their advocacy, which was not the case before.
Right. That's great.
You know, we're in this, you know, talking about feminism, we're in this world of Me Too-ness and all of that. What do you think are the current issues that need to be addressed? For instance, as you were saying, the fact that we're multifaceted women, nobody addresses that.
Yeah.
They keep thinking of women as one clump, but you could be a Muslim woman, you could be, and that too, blah, blah, blah.
I think, the one issue that we've been very passionate about, which has been stalled in the state of California, which is where we're at, is the fact that there's no age limit for marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
Children being forced into marriage, boys and girls, but obviously primarily girls. So when they are forced into marriage, it's because they've been raped or they the parents feel that, oh, you're becoming too Americanized and you need to clamp it down, so I'm going to marry off to someone from your own village, from back home, whatever. Or you're from a conservative community, you know, isolationist, like Orthodox, some segment of Orthodox Jews, Christians, and Muslims. So it's not just a Muslim thing. It's actually really across the board. Mm-hmm. So the more conservative they are, the more the girls are forced into marriage. Most of them are in the rural areas as well.
But what's the legal age in California? It's not 18?
No. It's with parental consent.
Yeah.
And if you get the right judge, they'll marry you.
Which is shocking when you think that, you know, you always hear people talk about how liberal California is. Yeah. And then yet you have...
Yeah, we forget.
Yeah, and that's such a subjective thing depending on which judge you get. Like, that's, right. No, that's kind of...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And, hey, you know, you get a judge and, you know... Bishop, California, which is population 5,000.
I've driven through there many times. Right? I've had coffee there.
And versus a judge in Los Angeles, you're going to get a different ruling, right?
That's right. Yeah, for sure.
Right, totally. So let's back up a step now to an anthology you put together in 2011. Mm. You were able to collect a lot of stories in there. And so I'm kind of curious, how were you able to use this anthology to kind of shine a positive light on the people you featured? And how could you kind of use a storytelling device like this to actually facilitate change?
Yeah, I was doing that in 2011. Wow. Yeah. Okay.
That was just the other day.
Yeah, right.
No, it's precisely because the misunderstanding of what Muslim is and should be, not just outside of the Muslim community, but also within the Muslim community. Right. I mean, there's such a, we're supposed to fit into this really stupid box about what a Muslim is. Uh-huh. You know, it's like, no.
You know,
we're supposed to actually, Islam is supposed to liberate us from this tiny box that you want to put us in. Mm-hmm. So so I collected all these dynamic and also diverse backgrounds and stories so to highlight the different belief system and how they journeyed into the journey, into the path that they are, and their spiritual journey. Mm-hmm. So it was very tough project, but it was definitely well worth it.
Okay.
So, you know, we always have storytellers here, and
Gesundheit,
bless you.
Bless you. Dankeschön.
We are truly an international show.
I was going to say we're global here at Storytellers in Action.
I'm supposed to say Alhamdulillah, so let me just put that out there.
You could say whatever you like.
You could say whatever you like. Alhamdulillah, my sister. But you know, going back to your music, and you know, obviously, music is one way you tell your stories or story. With your identity as being a progressive Muslim, among other things that are part of your identity, how do you go about that process of instilling those insights, your story, into the music that you create?
It's not very difficult. So one of my first songs was called Just Like Khadija, and I produced, the CD was called Umma Wake Up, and I produced it like a pop producer would, like full on instrumentation and all that. And none of the Islamic retail stores would sell it because they said, well, first of all, you're a female singer and your voice is supposed to be covered. It's haram.
Wow.
And then number two, you use all the musical instrumentation, and Prophet Muhammad only used the percussion. So when I did the CD, I didn't realize I was actually breaking taboos. I had no idea. I just I was doing it because that I was compelled to do it, right? So it's not very difficult. All I did was take content of what I read and just put into words. And I spoke about how Khadija was the financier of the early Islamic society, Muslim society. Otherwise, they would have perished because she was a rich woman. She was the financier. Mm. Why are we discriminating against women, people?
Right.
You know, so it's not very difficult. And now what I started doing is actually going back to my classical roots. As a Western Muslim, we don't have worship songs, Islamic worship songs in English. So many of the members of our congregation are progressive Muslims. They love music. They sing. Mm. It's not a taboo as it is in most of 99.9% of the Sunni community and mosques, right? So what is decided to do was to create a collection of hymns, Islamic hymns, that are layered and layered of vocal arrangements like a Christian church choir. But the lyrics are from the Quran, or the lyrics is like Prophet Muhammad's favorite prayer, Rumi, Hafiz, and so on. But on classical But classical arrangement.
Right. So. As a follow-up to that, you were talking about certain musical styles or certain things that are considered a haram. Have you worked or made any music along like the Sufi lines? Obviously, there's a huge Sufi audience all throughout South Asia, the Indian subcontinent, and stuff. So,
well, that's the thing, right? As a Muslim in the West, everything that we have comes from somewhere else, mm-hmm. right? It's in Urdu, it's in Arabic, Turkish, what have you. We don't have anything that's English that is really homegrown, other than terrace. So,
<Ba-dunch>. So Marvin, maybe we can get that drum roll.
It's a rim shot.
So that's the thing. You can't beat those kind of poetry from the South Asian, Pakistani Urdu. Those poets are remarkable. Yeah. I mean, no, I can't compete with that.
There were a lot of people that were conceived because of those poems.
So, Ani, where can we find out more about your group and about you? Do you have a Twitter? Do you have a website? Mm-hmm. Or just share with us all the places we could find you.
Sure. You can Google Ani Zonneveld and a lot will pop up. Mm-hmm. Muslims for Progressive Values, that's something else you can Google. And I'd appreciate if people followed our work because we are making ground earthquake work. And we could use the support. I'm on Twitter as well, Ani Zonneveld. And
And do you mind spelling your name just so people
hear it? Sure. It's Ani, A-N-I, Zonneveld, Z as in zebra, O-N-N as in Nancy, E-V as in Victor, E-L-D as in David, Zonneveld.
Great. And for everybody that wants to continue this conversation and hear more, we could obviously find us online. Our email address is asian.highway.live@gmail.com. Could also find us on Facebook by looking up Asian Highway 1. Our Twitter and our Instagram have the same handle. The handle is AH1 Live. And
you can also find this story and others on iTunes, Google Play Music, Spotify, and YouTube.
And as always, we got to give a shout out to all the people who helped make this happen. First of all, Ani, thank you so much for coming and talking with us. Great conversation. Rachel Stein, who was in here helping out with her photography. I believe, Ani, you have a guest here too,
yes,
as well.
My very, very awesome assistant, Yasmin Kadir.
Nice to have you guys. And Marvin Yue, as always, doing an amazing job on production. And we're always thankful for him. Thankful for Visual Communications here in Little Tokyo for being supportive as well. And I think we had a great show today, fellas.
Arigato gozaimasu.
Hi, hi.
On that note, Devesh, you have our takeaway for today.
Absolutely. Be good, y'all.
All right. Good night. Good day, wherever you are.